Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. On this day in 1924, James Baldwin was born. And James Baldwin is a writer whose name lives on, who has had an effect, I think, on our society when he was alive. He was a man who was, in many ways, maligned by many when he was alive, even in the black community, people going back and forth. He was a sellout to the whites. He was a hero to what he had to say, a man who kind of lived his life in his own way, and also his works inspired so many. Ta-Nehisi Coates and his latest work were inspired in many ways by what James Baldwin did in writing to his nephew. So we are going to wrestle with and talk about James Baldwin this hour with our guests. Old friend joins us here on the air, E. Ethelbert Miller, literary activist, board chairperson, Institute for Policy Studies. His latest book of poetry is out that we will one day very soon get to sit an hour and talk about poetry and nothing else but Ethelbert's work. Ethelbert, good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Mark.
Abdu Ali, a writer, local writer and musician, is with us as well. Abdu, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hello. What's up?
And Kevin Brown joins us, owner of Station North Arts Cafe and Nancy, the two wonderful restaurants, and founder of the James Baldwin Literary Society here in Baltimore City. Good to have you on the air, Kevin.
Thanks, Mark, for having me on. It's always a good time to talk about James Baldwin.
And you're always ready.
Two really great people as well, Abdu and Ethelbert Miller as well.
And y'all can join us at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, but do jump in, 410-319-8888, and we're going to play a little bit of James Baldwin here before we go to break in about 10 minutes or so. But it is, you know, James Baldwin, I mean, for many of us, Ethelbert, let me start with you. I mean, you've written a lot about James Baldwin, and we've talked together about James Baldwin a great deal. And he was just somebody, as I tried to say earlier, was, you know, he went through so much. I mean, I was thinking about the 1960s. I was thinking about how Eldridge Cleaver attacked him, about how he was hurt by the betrayal of Richard Wright, and King's decision not to put him up on the to speak on the March on Washington in 1963. Mm. But also just, you know, what he brought to us in all that time and living through all those contradictions. Talk a bit about what he means to you.
I think his key is that we always realize that Baldwin comes out of the black church, comes out of that spirit. He also always saw himself as a witness, and that's very important because we're not talking about Baldwin being an observer. He's talking about him being a witness. And by being a witness, one has to bring a certain degree of compassion to what one does. One also has to give testimony and testify. And I think that when we look at his life, we see that. I think it's very important to acknowledge, especially in 2016, that Baldwin was a gay African-American male, you know, and writer. He also needs to be viewed not just as a novelist, but as a member of the civil rights movement. And I say that so that he's not just taught in an English class. Keep in mind that Baldwin sort of operates between King and Malcolm, the two people that were very important to his life. And that sometimes that I think is very important to look at Baldwin in terms of the African-American that is able to step outside of the country and look at America. And I'm looking at Baldwin's time in Paris as well as a place like Istanbul.
I mean, you know, I think of Baldwin, I was thinking about a book that I have really mixed emotions about, which is Douglas Fields' All Those Strangers, that he wrote about Baldwin. And there was a quote that I pulled out of an article recently that I read on all of this. And he said, Baldwin the deviant rabble-rouser, Baldwin the civil rights activist, Baldwin the passé novelist, and homosexual sidelined by black nationalists.
Wow.
Baldwin the expatriate, and Baldwin struggling to work out his conflicted relationship to Africa. I mean, that was
vitriolic. At best.
Kevin.
Man, oh man, a Shevitz. Baldwin was also a very polarizing person. Yeah. You either loved him or you hated him. And you brought up the guy, Eldridge Cleaver.
Yes.
Whose personal attack on James Baldwin just floored him because, you know, Jimmy said at the time that he'd never even met Eldridge Cleaver. So for him to go on about homosexuals and the civil rights movement and how they couldn't be effective or they couldn't be positive just absolutely floored me. But he was a polarizing person, and that description of that you just read,
right,
is so right on.
So, and you met James Baldwin.
Absolutely. Back in 1992, thank you to Stanjo Javatsky, who used to be the managing director of Center Stage. He brought Jimmy to Baltimore to oversee the production of Amen Corner that Center Stage was doing back in 82. And James Baldwin, I had a party for him at my house up on Guilford Avenue. And Jimmy came and stayed till 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was one of those life-changing experiences where you get to sit at the feet of a master and just have him pour out manna from heaven. It was like a night like no other.
In terms of the 21st century, Abdu Ali, as a young writer-poet in this community, and what Baldwin means to you?
I mean, I think that I was first introduced to James Baldwin, luckily, at an early age. I was somewhere around 11, 12, when my middle school teacher made us read Go Tell It on the Mountain in middle school. And I remember just being just so captivated by that novel because, I mean, it was just so traumatic. And I don't know if it was traumatic at the same time for me at that age, but I just remember just being caught by the language and the fiction in that book and finally reading somebody in school that I can, like, relate to the way they were talking. Even though, I mean, obviously James Baldwin talks in such an elegant, you know, high man away at that age, I would still be able to relate to the way he was talking or written in that novel because, I mean, it was just kind of like listening to, like, your old grandmother write a really, really, really excellent book. I mean, I just feel like, you know, for me, the elders in my family and in black families always, for me, were able to talk so elegantly and beautifully, and, you know, it was just beautiful to see that written in a novel at such a young age.
And in some ways, Ethelbert, I think that and you've written about this a little bit, that though Baldwin has never been forgotten, nor should he be, nor was he, in many ways, Ta-Nehisi Coates resurrected him in ways in the public eye in this century more than anybody else, I think.
Yeah, that's true. You know, because he uses the format in terms of, you know, Baldwin's talking about his nephew and Coates is talking about his son. And I think it gets back to what Abdu was just saying. You know, when Baldwin comes back to the United States in 57, he sort of sees himself as an older brother to many, like, the young people in the civil rights movement, like, were in SNCC. And so, you know, there's a protection that he tried to provide, and his work has a lot to do with that. So I think we need to always look at his age in relation to other people, because that, and he was an old soul also. You know, one of the things I would say about this, a lot of people make these connections because of the format of Coates' book, but I think that Coates has more in common with August Wilson than James Baldwin.
What do you mean by that?
I couldn't agree more.
I say that because, you know, a key thing in Coates' book, you know, Between the World and Me, is not believing in God. I mean, that's a very important thing. You know, Coates is not a very religious person. He does not come out of the church like Baldwin did.
Right,
and
right.
That's a major thing. And when you look at August Wilson is a blues guy. You see, August Wilson always has a character on his stage that's looking up, questioning God, calling God a mean MF. You know,
that right, that great, that great speech in Headley, right?
Right. And I think what happens is that, you know, this is where we look at the packaging of Coates' book, not taking anything away from it, but, you know, that's set in motion by Toni Morrison. You know, and so we have to realize, okay, a connection is made here, but I think that when I look at great writers, August Wilson is major. We just don't replay, but when I put Ta-Nehisi's work up against, you know, August, I see a nice straight line, and that, I think, needs to be looked at. And it comes back to getting back to Baldwin. I mean, you started the show talking about your earlier show, talking about the flooding in Maryland, and I chuckled about that because I said, oh, okay, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, you know, no more water, the fire next time.
You know, my favorite.
You know, we seem to be, you know, Baldwin is as prophet is what we begin to see now, especially when you look at what was happening last year in Baltimore.
I think it's funny that people say that James Baldwin is back. I had a young kid say the other day to me, oh, James Baldwin, he's back. And I was like, what would Jimmy say given these circumstances in Baltimore's uprising? And I have to go back to the letter to my nephew, where he actually, line by line, laid out this scenario that it was going to happen, that America was going to combust or implode or explode if we didn't fix this racism issue that we had then and still have now.
It hasn't gone anywhere. And it's changed, but it hasn't gone anywhere.
I got into my feelings with Toni Morrison's comment about Coates being Baldwin-esque. I thought that was a little early for her to exalt him to that status. But many people believe that he was closer to Baldwin. I tend to believe he was closer to August Wilson, like you say. I couldn't agree more.
Let me go to the phones here. Folks calling, can I join us with your thoughts on James Baldwin? I mean, why he is so important to you, what you think that he said or written that means the most to you. And we all can question why there's not more James Baldwin in our schools. Well, why we're not teaching our kids more about James Baldwin as part of the canon of who we are as a people. 410-319-8888. Jude Lombardi, you're on the air. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Mark.
Hi, Judy.
Hi, Kevin. Wish I could be there tonight for the Baldwin event, but I can't. I have to go take care of honeybee.
I know, bees over Baldwin.
I'm sorry. What I wanted to say is something I haven't heard yet was the relationship between Baldwin and Margaret Mead. And the book Rap on Race, and Kevin knows how I feel about this, that it was such an important relationship and text about what has changed and, more importantly, what hasn't changed. And that I think that it is a book that really could enlighten us about our relations between our different ethnicities and what some like to call still race, and I understand that. So I just want to put that out there.
Well, that's interesting.
That is an incredible text, A Rap on Race. And it's one of those dialogues that you have to read and reread and reread because Margaret Mead and James Baldwin didn't agree, as Judy will tell you, throughout that discussion. There were points of contention where Jimmy just wouldn't relent. And, well, he believed Margaret Mead was taking the white superiority path. And he would, you know, hunker down and they would disagree. But it's probably one of the best dialogues on the racial climate in America for its time.
You know, when you say that, I think that's a good example in terms of when we talk about, you know, having these dialogues and things of that sort. But I think it's very important in terms of, you know, who was having the dialogue. You know, I think it's very important to talk to somebody like me, a cultural anthropologist. You know, it's a different type of dialogue.
And he had a similar dialogue, too, with Nikki Giovanni, which I think is just as important.
Right, right. And then, you know, when we mention these, you know, this Rap on Race or the dialogue between Nikki Giovanni, we're talking about texts by Baldwin that are somewhat overlooked. One that I would mention in this program would be Blues for Mr. Charlie. Mm. And if you go back to the eulogy that Amiri Baraka gave in 87 at Baldwin's funeral, he said he felt, and this is Baraka saying, so the Black Arts Movement started with Blues for Mr. Charlie. You know, and I went back and I looked at that play and reading a play and seeing a play too, and saying, when you read it, you stop at certain lines. And you see the whole thing of youth in that play wrestling with, you know, becoming a man, you know, the whole issue of power. You know, the whole thing of picking up the gun. All these issues, you know, that Baldwin is dealing with in the early 60s. You know, and that's a very important production. And, of course, if we would try to put that on today, somebody would say, well, you know, I really have a problem with the N-word. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't see the production because somebody wants to get caught in that. Don't get me started.
I do want to get you started.
But it is a very important thing. And I think, you know, when we talk about Baldwin. You know, I looked at how Baraka praised him, and it's this fantastic eulogy, and he sort of summed up Baldwin's life, and I felt that I learned a lot from that eulogy. It forced me to go back and look at this manner of man.
And I was thinking about this. We got to take a break here, don't we? A quick break? But I want us to think about, before we go to Owusu, who's calling in to comment on Baldwin, is that so I'm thinking about the Baldwin-Giovanni conversation. I mean, he was like in his mid-40s. She was like in her 20s when they had this conversation.
Absolutely.
Right? The more I think about it, the more I think about how interesting it would be to kind of resurrect the Baldwin-Giovanni conversation and the Baldwin-Mead conversation.
Wow.
And create that as a conversation among us about what that really means. Maybe have our listeners go to our website, look at those texts, and really kind of wrestle with the things they were talking about. It would be an interesting way to do that in the coming month.
Absolutely.
So we're going to take a short break, come back, and continue our conversation about James Baldwin. We'll see you the next caller up. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show as we explore this day, James Baldwin's birthday. born on this day in 1924, one of the most significant figures in my life. I began reading James Baldwin when I was, let me think, 14, 13.
Wow, you know? That's a big chunk to bite at 14.
I was a strange little boy, but
we know that. Everybody who knows you knows that, Mark. You're a strange man.
Kevin Brown's with us, owner of Station North Arts Cafe, and of course Nancy as well, founder of the James Baldwin Literary Society. Tonight at Nancy's Cafe, from
6 to 8:30,
he'll be having his annual James Baldwin birthday night. Well, he'll be serving fried chicken, greens,
cornbread,
beer, and wine.
Free
and open to the public. And Ethelbert Miller's with us. You heard him just there on the phone, a literary activist, board chairperson at the Institute of Policy Studies, one of our leading poets. His new book of poetry is out. And Abdul Ali, writer and musician, is with us as well. And you all are 410-319-8888. Let's go right to Owusu. You're on the air.
I just finished reading Herb Boyd's Baldwin's Harlem, and one of your guests just mentioned the eulogy that Barack gave at his funeral.
Yes.
But the book pointed out that early on, Barack was very, very critical. And I noticed that there were complicated relationships, for example, with Langston Hughes as well. Over time, it changed from positive to negative, et cetera. So I'm asking your guest, number one, their opinion of Herb Boyd's book and why the change in Barack's view of Baldwin. Was it a matter of getting wiser with age or a late appreciation of his work?
Interesting. Anybody want to grab that first?
I have not read that book.
I've not read it either.
But I do know that that Jimmy's relationship with Amiri Baraka changed throughout the years. So imagine our surprise when he was actually called to eulogize him at St. Peter's back in 1987 when he died. He gave a very eloquent and cogent and thought-provoking eulogy that moved everybody there.
Yeah, you have any thoughts on that, Ethelbert?
Well, you know, what happens is that many of the relationships between writers that we sometimes see played out in the media is not necessarily the case when you see these individuals, you know, off stage. I don't know, there is a certain degree of closeness, and that, I think, is very important. This is why sometimes it's very important to go to writers' correspondence to see how it changed. Keep in mind that there was a point in which, you know, Barack was changing his ideology and was very critical of a lot of people at different stages. And in the later part of his life, I think with the help of Amina, he probably restored ties with everybody he had ever criticized, with probably the exception of Stanley Crouch.
And Norman Mailer. He never made up with Norman Mailer.
Right. You know, but, you know, I think that when you look at, you know, focusing on Baraka right now, Baraka went through a lot of changes, and you know, some of the things in terms of him attacking had nothing to do with his personal life, you know, in terms of the closeness, in terms of him. I mean, I just, a couple of weeks ago, interviewed Hetty Jones, and the Leroy Jones that she describes, you know, that's very important to her life, is a completely different picture of somebody seeing Barack around by this angry man, you know. And so I think it's very important that when we start talking about Baldwin or Barack or any others, you know, who are no longer with us, how we introduce them to a new generation, mm-hmm. or how we remember them to a new generation is very important. And you said something before we went to the commercial. Yes, going back to specific texts that have not moved. I'll give you an example. The rapper Rick never moved in the 40 years I was at Howard University. Okay? It was on a shelf, and it never moved. No one taught it in class. You know, the same way How I Stand by Paul Robeson never moved. You know, nothing by Kelly Miller ever moved. You know, and so that has a lot to do with, if you want to talk about the gaps in our educational knowledge, I mean, who's teaching the crisis of Negro intellectual by Harold Cruz? Who ever heard of Oliver Cox? I go down a list of names.
Right.
And when we get to Baldwin, we don't want to teach Baldwin when we teach these survey classes. Oh, okay, class, we're going to restudy blues. And that's it.
You're right.
Right. So Nancy has written in saying, I wish I could call in. I used to hook school during high school at the Central Library, hiding there, reading everything I could get my hands on by and about James Baldwin. Abdul, let me come back to you as a young poet and writer. And just this whole, given where we've come from the moment where Baldwin was and living, especially as a young man, and wait, the things you have kind of given to the public in your poetry and writing, your kind of thoughts about Baldwin on notions of queerness and masculinity and Baldwin. I mean, reflect on that a bit for us as a young poet.
I mean, as I've said before, you know, when I first read Baldwin, which was Go Tell on the Mountain, like I said, I was very, like, satisfied as a young little reader to see somebody who can talk in the language that I can relate to. But then in high school, I figured out, well, I learned that he was also a gay man. And me being a gay man, I was just gagging because, like, you know, at that time especially, you know, I think that, you know, now we're a little bit more acceptable in, like, pop culture as far as queerness and gayness. But back in when I was in high school, that was like, no. That was still like a no.
Right.
So when I learned that he was, I forgot what exactly we were reading in high school. I think it was that book he wrote, Born Off and Shade and Native Son.
Uh-huh.
That book. And my teacher had told us that he was a gay man. I was just, you know, at that time, I was just ecstatic and happy to see that, you know, I can have a role model, you know, and somebody I can relate to. And not just, you know, in a language way, but also a lifestyle way. So, yeah, it meant a lot to me to have that kind of figure, especially somebody of his caliber and somebody who was so honored in our culture to be, you know, be a role model for me. So, yeah.
And I think I think that's doubly, even maybe even triply more important today for African-American writers mm-hmm. who are gay to have that type of iconic, if I can say, writer
yeah.
who really didn't play his sexuality out, but everybody knew he was gay, to be this great literary giant, to be this behemoth of, you know, black knowledge that he's become for so many people that shows that actually identifies and shows and demonstrates that being black and being gay and being poor is not the end of the world. That there's up to that.
Mm-hmm. Can I comment on that? Because
go ahead.
Go ahead. About that, you know, he talked about he felt like he had hit the jackpot. You know, all the, you know,
I love that quote.
Find his way. But you know, he also, you know, emphasized this is more of the individual. But he was not going to let anyone define him in terms of who he should love or not love. And I think that's very important. And we're dealing with these Baldwin as an individual before there is really a gay movement that we see, you know,
mm-hmm,
today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same way, for example, you know, we look at Black Lives Matter. I think it's very important to realize that the fathers of Black Lives Matter are gay women, you know, so that we understand that our struggle is one in which, you know, people have this role. You know, I don't feel like we need to be explaining Ray Rutten every generation, you
right,
know.
Right.
You know, what happened is that this is part of our movement. You know, the homophobia is still there, and what happens is that Baldwin becomes a good individual to teach because what happened, you cannot put a label on him and say, okay, I'm going to ignore his work because he was gay, you know. And then for people who now don't have to live in a closet or an attic or whatever, you know, Baldwin is important to them, and they realize that. When we talk about Baldwin, the art of sexuality, Baldwin is always, always, always talking about love. And that is key to our movement. And this is why I say, if you want to understand the civil rights movement, you go to Martin Luther King's sermons, not his speeches, sermons, and then you go to Baldwin's essay.
Love.
And then you ask yourself, okay, this is what it means to be an American.
That's really very powerfully said, Ethelbert. I think that's really
Absolutely.
Important. I mean, and I think that the part about what it means to be an American, that America needs to understand, I think, how it has been defined by its blackness. And Baldwin speaks to that with real clarity, I think.
Oh, yeah, there's an essay in you know, discovering what it means to be an American, you know. And every house, you know, we say, you know, every house should have the price of the ticket, you know. We need to get back to that. You know, there's certain things that if you're raising black men and black children, there's certain texts that need to be in black homes. You know, I remember at one time everybody had a Bible. You know, there's other things that need to go along with a one book, and I think the price of the ticket is one of them.
Let me open the phones here, and I want to come back to something that happened on Martin Luther King's birthday, that when my Dungeon Shook was read by Chris Rock. But let me come back to that in a moment. 410-319-8888. Lavana, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mark. Thanks a lot for taking the call. I just want to throw in that even though it's a completely peripheral, that Baldwin was writing from his experience and talking to people who shared that experience. For me, as a teenager, starting to read first Langston Hughes and then Baldwin, it just deepened what my parents had already established in me. I got it from a very young age, and I've read and read and read other black writers. And as a white person, I want to celebrate that by just doing his life, he made windows open up for white people, and I hope we keep using that to try to get people to get it. I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Lana, so much for that. Before we go to Charles, our next caller, and I really think that it'd be good for us to hear a little bit of James Baldwin's voice. And this is just one piece. We could pull out a dozen pieces. Another day we will, maybe. But let's just hear this one clip. I think if I pull out the right one, this is about Baldwin and race.
Most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, that the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates black people, but I know the textbooks they give my children to read and the schools that we have to go to. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
Abdu, he could be talking about this morning. On some levels, yeah, right?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly things have changed, but I mean, they have changed. I mean, people think everything is static and never changes. I mean, that's absurd to me. I mean, that racism is still with us, but this is not 1963. This is 2016. But Abdu, your reflections again.
You know what I was just thinking about? I don't know why that conversation made me think about why to Paris. I'm always, I don't know, thinking about why he really moved to Paris.
Like, that's why he went to Paris. Reason. Mark's going to tell you.
What? Yeah, please tell me. Because I don't know, a lot of people have a lot of theories about why he really went to Paris.
Here's why.
He left New York on November the 11th, 1948, with just $40 in his pocket and no real prospect of earning any more. Quote, he said, "It wasn't so much a matter of choosing France, it was a matter of getting out of America. I had to get my head together to survive, and my only hope of doing that was to leave America." That was courtesy of our dear friend Kevin Brown, who brought this into the studio.
And I think Jimmy also felt he had every right to attack America because he loved America. And so he could speak out against America and its racial practices and still love it.
Ethel, you got a thought on this before we open the phones again?
Baldwin's temperament was one of you know, being confrontational, you know, and he realized, I mean, there's an incident where he was young, he went to sleep. He thought that if he stayed here, he probably would get killed, you know, until he left. And I think another thing that's very important, you know, just gets past Paris, but when he's in Switzerland, you know, when he, you know, puts on those Bessie Smith records, and hears Bessie in a different way, you know, getting outside, but, you know, sometimes you've got to be away from the U.S. to realize, okay, this is what Bessie Smith is singing. You know, I hear her in a completely new way. I remember in 1974, man, I was in Tanzania, and some brother had a tape of John Coltrane. Man, I woke up in the morning, I saw Africa, and I saw the rest of the universe. You know, I love the free. Okay, I couldn't see the stars in New York or D.C., but when I got over there, man, and I looked at the sky, and I heard that music from somebody, like, you know, a little recording. You know, I said, "Wow, this is what he was playing in the rule of notes." And for Baldwin to listen to Bessie Smith, you know, I said, "Okay, now he can come back and write anything he wants after that."
That's very powerfully said, Ethelbert. I love that. I love that. I love that. I haven't heard that story before. 410-319-8888. Charles Park Heights, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thanks. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
I just want to commend you for having a program like this. I mean, it's so necessary. I mean, I think it was Harry Truman said, "The only thing new in the world is the history you don't already know." And these guys, to me, you know, Baldwin, he's talking about other black Baraka. The things they were talking about years ago, to me, they still resonate today, and they're right there for our young people to take advantage of. And, you know, I saw this thing on YouTube. I'll be real quick.
That's right.
Where Baldwin was debating William F. Buckley.
Yes.
It was just dynamite. Yeah, it was dynamite. And especially when you think about the context of the time. And when, you know, you see young people nowadays, I had a situation where a kid was talking, and he said, "Boy, you speak funny." And I said, "What?" He says, "Well, you know, you sound strange." And really, I know he was alluding to the fact, he says, "Well, you know, you sound white." And I get really angered because they act as though speaking in King's English is the exclusive province of people who are non-black, you know, people who aren't black. And I remember back in the day, that's how our parents raised us. Speak the King's English, and Baldwin and all these guys, they were examples of that. And he's the type of guy I put forth when I give those examples to young people. And finally, can you tell me where Nancy's is? I mean, can you mention that again?
Now, Nancy's is at 131 West North Avenue at Maryland Avenue, 131, and it's in the MICA building on the first floor.
Okay.
You'll see red chairs out front. We'll be there from 6 o'clock to 8:30 tonight.
Okay. Right.
Please
Thanks
come for readings and writings and music and food.
Hey, keep it coming, man. Keep it coming.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you so much for the call, Charles. Thank you so
much. Hey, Mark, could I say something?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, you know, since some of your viewers and listeners are, will probably see Baldwin until the YouTube and hear him that way. One of the things I find going back is, and this has a lot to do with the public intellectual, there was a way people held their cigarettes, you know, and made gestures. You know, and if we probably brought back the cigarettes, the black intellectual today, they would probably be smarter.
I always like how, man.
And they would talk, and it was never any ashtrays. Like, their ashes never fell, so they were that profound.
They were
but
cool.
You go back and look at this, they're smoking, there's no ashes, there's no ashtray, and they gesture with a cigarette. And I mean, I think, you know, that's missing. I don't see, you know, maybe Cornell and Geisen don't smoke. Maybe they're vegetarians or something. But, you know, there's something lost in this. Oh, Cornell's the worst, too. So he's going to have that. Maybe we should give him a cigarette to hold in his hand the next time he's fucking. But Baldwin has that, you know? And I just think it's another fun style. And we talk about that the same way we talk about jazz musicians. And I guess Cornell that a style. You know, there's a book out about Frederick Douglass and how he was photographed. And I think that's something that we sometimes forget, that a success of how these people package themselves and saw themselves. We talk about him being eloquent. Well, he looked good, you know? Like, I never saw him. You know, I never saw people.
Right.
Like, Baldwin thought he was ugly.
He thought he was ugly.
I thought he was beautiful, man. I mean, he had that face, like, because he's so good. You know, the eyes.
Teased as a child, called frog eyes.
Right.
Right. You know, we should jump as much as the frogs.
I mean, I wish, and I hear about the cigarettes. If they didn't kill you, I missed them.
Right, I missed them too. I never smoked. Never.
I missed them, but you know, I think Baldwin had so many interesting things he said about certain things, especially about who we are as a people. Nobody knows my name. I was thinking he wrote "The Country's Image of the Negro," which hasn't very much to do with the Negro. Has never failed to reflect with a kind of frightening accuracy the state of mind of the country.
Wow.
You know, he really sat back and really reflected. And one more part, from The Fire Next Time, just how he reflects on things. In The Fire Next Time, Baldwin wrote, "Whatever white people do not know about Negroes reveals precisely and inexorably what they do not know about themselves."
True.
Right?
True. That was from a letter letter to my nephew, that passage that you just read.
And you know, that when it was interesting that they chose Chris Rock to read that at Riverside Church, that he read that letter. He read "My Dungeon Shook," mm-hmm. Letter to My Nephew. And I found that so interesting that was, you know, that they chose him. He also left out one of the most important lines in the thing. With using the N-word, he wouldn't say that for some reason. He cut that out. I don't know why he did that, but they did that.
Mm-hmm. See, that's what I was saying about, you know, Bluesman's Charlie, that what happened, we don't understand the importance of language. You know, that if there's one thing, you know, everybody's talking about, it loses its eloquence. You know, people used to punctuate with certain words, you see, and so you had to say that because
it had to be spelled. It had to be spelled.
And you must agree, most of Jimmy's words were warnings.
Yeah.
They were warnings of what was to come.
Yes, they were. Two quick things. Let me write this right here before we run out of time. Don Palmer tweeted in and wrote in. Nice segment. I once had the fortune or miss to spend a long night until morning chatting and drinking with Jimmy with Baldwin. Fascinating and funny. Decolonize your mind. Tweets in. Can we talk about James Baldwin's encounters at the White House? We have 3 minutes left.
Yes.
So on that note, who
in
wants
a
to?
Nutshell, well, do you want to talk about this, Elphaber?
We have
no,
3 minutes.
I'm listening.
In a nutshell, Jimmy was invited by President Kennedy. I believe he took Lorraine Hansberry, Ruby Dee, Harry Belafonte, Cassius Clay, some other people of the time, to actually sit down with Robert F. Kennedy, who was then the Attorney General, to find out what it was that black people in this country wanted so they could stop rebelling. What is it that the Negro wants? Which was, to me, an incredible, funny question to ask when you're sicking dogs on people and putting hoses on people and telling people to stay in their place. So Jimmy and his entourage arrived at the White House, and they've received a tongue lashing more than anything because James Baldwin was confident and competent in expressing himself, and he pretty much laid it on the line. Ethelbert?
Yeah, you know, what happens, this is...
About a minute and a half, Ethelbert.
Oh, no, I'm just saying, Baldwin speaks from stuff, you know, and I think that just shows here, this dialogue at race begins at the highest level, and I hope that there's other writers that will shall we say, meet whoever is the next president at the White House, because it's definitely going to be a need for dialogue.
That's Ethelbert Miller, literary activist, board chair of the Institute for Policy Studies. The collected poems of Ethelbert Miller are now out, and soon we will be having a long-ranging conversation with Ethelbert about his poetry on the air here. You heard Kevin Brown, owner of Station North Arts Cafe, and Nancy, founder of the James Baldwin Literary Society, tonight from 6 to 8:30 at 131 West North Avenue at Nancy's. There'll be the James Baldwin annual celebration on his birthday. Fried chicken, greens, beer, and wine, and cornbread. Can't leave out the cornbread. I love some cornbread. And Abdul Ali, writer, musician, inspired by James Baldwin. Thank the three of you so much for spending this time with us today talking about the great James Baldwin.
Thank you, Mark. I love you, man.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you all here.
All right.
On the way out of here, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ Baltimore's Credit Union is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Or SteinerShow.org is MeQ Baltimore Credit Union's banner. And they bring you discussions like this James Baldwin discussion. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Armani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@SteinerShow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at SteinerShow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.